630 CHED Afternoons with Jalen Nye. Weekdays at 2 on 630 CHED.
You know, we went through that long stretch of hot weather, and all you have to do is look at your yards, probably your garden, to realize the impact that weather had on the area. Now, we've had some rain over the past couple of days. Last night, certainly today, that thunderstorm last night, as I was mentioning. Was it something else at your place? Because we were right on the southwest edge of the city, and it rolled through pretty good between 10 and 11 last night. But when we're having that rain last night and the rain today, it might be somewhat easy to forget about what's happening in Ontario with the forest fires and even in BC. And we'll have the very latest on that coming up. But we do know that the forest fire is causing major concerns, right? In Ontario, the premier there getting pressure to declare a state of emergency. And in BC, that state of emergency was put in place on Tuesday. More people are being forced to leave their homes. There are 277 forest fires burning across BC right now with no relief in sight. I'll give you the latest on that coming up. But our next guest to start with is an assistant professor in wildlife fire at the University of Alberta. And she says, while we can't predict the next wildfire disaster, we can plan for it. Jen Beverly, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. So when you take a look at the fires, or when we actually take a look, so I'm speaking from, you know, just, you know, someone with no expertise in fires. When we look at it, we see the terrifying videos and photos. For a lot of folks, it's putting a big cramp into their travel plans, you know, and tourism and that sort of thing. We shake our heads and we kind of go on with it. What do you see when you're looking at those videos and those pictures coming out of BC and northwestern Ontario right now?
Well, you know, the images are shocking, and like everyone, my concern is for the people who are there experiencing those events firsthand. Now, as a researcher, it's challenging me to ask, well, what can we do to help reduce the negative impacts of these destructive fires?
You have studied how wildfires in Canada have changed over the years, and one of the big forest fires that I remember was back in the same area, in the Okanagan, back in 2003, and I can remember covering that on television. I can remember originally seeing the video thinking, oh my gosh, you know, what is going on? I remember the stories of the firefighters, all of that, like it was yesterday. But there's, you know, there's been some big changes since 2003. When you look at what has happened with wildfires since then, the number of people evacuated, the amount of damage. Can you tell us about those changes that you've witnessed and that you followed and researched?
Yeah, there has been a lot of changes. So that Okanagan Mountain Park fire, 2003, Kelowna, several hundred homes destroyed. And people started asking, you know, how often does this happen? Nobody was tracking it. There were no national statistics on wildfire evacuations. And that actually led us, and at the time I worked for the federal government, and I led a project to compile the historical evacuation records. And we were able to do that going back to about 1980. So the study was published 10 years ago. But that study actually concluded that up until that point, for the 30 years that we could get the data, fires were not really impacting that many Canadians. On average, up until that point, pretty small numbers of people were being evacuated each year. So you're talking about around 7,500 people a year, 18 homes on average were being burned each year by wildfire nationally. Now, the last 10 years look completely different. Uh-huh. In the last 10 years, what we've seen is just a succession of fire disasters and extreme fire seasons, and they just keep coming. So we had Slave Lake in 2011, Fort McMurray in 2016. Both BC and Alberta have had these multiple escalated fire seasons in the last few years. And now we actually have, you know, multiple provinces simultaneously, as you mentioned. You know, we've got Ontario, Manitoba, BC. Evacuations are happening this summer across the country. So it's actually completely different. We've really shifted to this whole new state.
So instead of it kind of being a one-off if it's going to happen, it's almost like just when is it going to happen? And that leads to my next question, Jen. Is it possible to predict fires, wildfires, based on weather, past conditions, and previous fires. Is it possible to predict where the next ones might happen?
Well, we're pretty good at predicting things, you know, over really short timelines. So we have Canadian fire weather indices, and those are used to make maps that show what areas are receptive to ignitions today and tomorrow. And those maps are pretty reliable for as long as we can predict the weather, which is over the next few days. But if we want to be proactive, we need to try to understand what could happen over much longer time periods. So what could we expect next year and the next few years? And we're not good at predicting that because we can't predict where the ignitions are going to be. And we can't predict exactly when we're going to have that ignition, those extreme winds, and the drought conditions, exactly when and where that's going to happen. It's really too variable when you try to account for all of those things. Hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I shifted my research focus away from trying to predict strategically longer term and say, okay, what do we know and what can we do with what we know to try to prepare for it? And that's more about what if scenarios, like if a fire should come in from this direction, what's it going to mean?
Yeah, and you know, I thought I was reading an article that you'd written recently talking about some of the work that you're doing with some of your other colleagues, talking about the pathways that fire can take, potential fire or pathways into communities, and looking then at how communities can take that knowledge and use it. So where are you on that front, and what does that look like?
Yeah, exactly. So what we're trying to understand is the fuels. Now, fuels, that's your hazard for wildfire. And we know what fuels, and that's vegetation, biomass, live and dead, burn and how they burn. And we know where they are. So you can map the fuels, and we can have that knowledge with 100% certainty. So we look at those fuels, and then we can start asking, okay, where are the locations that fire can transmit itself to? Because, you know, fire is going to launch embers and radiant heat, and that's how it actually moves into the built environment, the community. So we understand the proximity of the fuels, how close they are, and when we can start to look at how connected those fuels are and identify, all right, here's the potential corridors or routes, pathways that a fire might take into a given community. Now, once you have that information, and that's something that me and my students are working on, we're also collaborating with transportation engineers, so Dr. Amy Kim at the University of British Columbia and her students, and we're starting to ask questions like, okay, let's look at the fire path, and that's the flow of fire potentially into a community. Now, how is that intersecting with the transportation network? Because that'll be the flow of people out during an evacuation. And you can start to look for vulnerabilities, like if you have your main fire pathway potentially cutting off your main escape route, this is a vulnerability, and you can identify that now. You don't have to wait for a fire to figure out where these vulnerabilities are.
And that takes me right back to Fort McMurray. I was on the air that afternoon when Fort McMurray went up in flames, and I was getting phone calls from people, you know, trying to get out of town. And just remember, there's only like one way in and one way out, and it was terrifying. So when you talk about planning, then planning isn't just making sure that, oh, you know, you've got your important documents on a personal level, but you're talking about planning for an entire community. So this information that you're working on can be used by communities across the province, across the country, in case something happens. I mean, I think that could go a long, long way to alleviating a small part of the critical parts of getting people out and getting people out safely.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, in these situations where you have really extreme winds, like what played out in Lytton, I mean, 60, 70 kilometer an hour winds, there's virtually no time to make decisions. Yeah. So it's important to think through this stuff and identify vulnerabilities well in advance and put contingencies in place. And it could be also looking at things like communications. You know, if your main fire pathways are also going to take out your cell phone communication towers, that's another vulnerability that you can identify, and potentially then you introduce some redundancy so you're protected. And so that's the kind of the stuff we're trying to promote with our work, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. It's, you know, a lot to think about right there. And it sounds like this is something that we should have been thinking about a while back. But at least I'm really happy that it's being worked on right now. Jen, I'm going to have to leave it here for the time being. Really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon and shedding some light on the work that you're doing.
Thanks so much. Have a great afternoon.
Yeah, take care. Jen Beverly this afternoon. She's an assistant professor of wildland fire at the University of Alberta. You heard her talk about the variables, the fuel and the winds. Well, the winds causing huge problems today, tomorrow in BC. I'll have the latest coming up.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.